Welcome to another study of the book of Esther, and we want to begin with our memory passages. We'll be looking at chapters 3 through 5 tonight, or whenever you happen to be listening to this. But let's begin with our memory passages, which are taken from the book of Daniel, Daniel 3, 17 and 18. And this is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego speaking. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. And then Daniel 6 and verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Both of those passages show us something about faith and courage, and may we learn from them. Well, we're looking at the book of Esther. It is a book that has a lot of drama in it. There are several things that and we would call great human interest stories, but it is so much more than that. Though it never mentions God, Yahweh, the Lord, it is a book that clearly portrays his providential working. And I believe it can strengthen our faith in God, our faith in prayer, as we see that God's hand is often manifested in unusual, unexpected ways, and things that, you know, one cannot directly attribute to God at the moment. But in looking back, we realize that God was at work in such a situation. Remember chapter 1, as we pointed out, this is a time that actually fits chronologically between chapter 6 and 7 of Ezra. Captives have been allowed to return, but not all the Jews have gone back to Judah, to the land of Canaan. And this story focuses on some of those who had remained behind. And in the first chapter, King Ahasuerus, who's also known in history as Xerxes, he becomes angry with his queen Vashti. She is deposed. And then in the second chapter, at the suggestion of some of his men, he sought a new queen. And they gathered the beautiful young virgins from around the empire and a young Jewish orphan named Hadassah, Esther, was chosen. Esther was an orphan, but she had been brought up by Mordecai. They are first cousins, but obviously there's an age gap here, and Mordecai is a father to her. And when she goes into become the queen, well, of course, there was the trial, and it was a year of purification and beauty treatments. But Mordecai had said, don't reveal who you are as far as being Jewish. At the end of the chapter, don't forget this, it won't really come into play so much in the lesson today, but it will in the next lesson. Mordecai is sitting in the king's gate. And that seems to imply that he has a position within the king's court. He has some kind of job there. But he learns of a plot against the king's life. He reveals this to Esther. Esther reveals it to the king in the name of Mordecai, and Mordecai's name is written in the Chronicles, you know, so that not the biblical book of Chronicles, but the records of the king of Persia, and that will come into play later on. But chapter 3 opens on a very sour note. There is a man named Haman, a man who is said to be the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. And this man is promoted by the king. and given to be above all the princes, and everybody in the king's gate is to bow down to him, pay him homage. But Mordecai will not bow to him and will not pay homage to him. And there is a lot we don't know about this. There are things that we're not told. This expression, the Agagite, what does that mean? There are some who trace this all the way back to Agag, king of the Amalekites. You remember in 1 Samuel 15 that Saul, and don't forget, Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin. Two of his ancestors have names that are found in the lineage of Saul. Whether they're the same two men or not, we don't know. But he is from that tribe of Benjamin that produced Saul. And some think that Agagite means a descendant of that king. Well, I don't know. That to me comes across as a bit of a stretch. And without any, you know, why would it not have said the Amalekite? You know, not the Agagite. I don't know. You know, what exactly was meant by an Agagite? And I don't know exactly why Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him. We see other times that the Jews would bow in respect toward a king. And it may well be that the kind of bowing and homage that was being paid here was viewed by Mordecai as worship, a violation of God's law. You know, I can't say with certainty, but I do know this, that some of the other servants, they made sure that Haman knew what Mordecai was not doing. And what we do know, you know, there are things we don't know, but what we do know is it filled Haman with wrath, verse 5. He was so angry, and he's this very powerful man and probably could have just had Mordecai killed. But his wrath was so great, and it is evident that there is a prejudice here that involves the fact that Mordecai was Jewish. And the fact that he has such hatred toward all the Jews makes me think, makes me, you know, at least lean toward the idea that whatever Mordecai's reasoning, it grew out of his Jewishness. That is, his place as an Israelite in the covenant. And he saw this as more than just giving respect to a man in authority. But it just outraged Haman. And he said, I'm going to get rid of all the Jews. And so, verse 7 says, in the first month, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. This is about 479 B.C., if you're wanting to keep up with the years. And they cast Pur, that is the lot. And Haman wants to make sure that he selects the very best day for his plot against the Jews. And so they cast the lot, and it falls on the 12th month, the month of Adar. They cast the lot in the first month, and the lot falls for the 12th month, 11 months away. In the absence of being told, I want to be careful, but it seems providential that there's going to be plenty of time for Mordecai and Esther to counteract this. That, as the writer of Proverbs would say, that the lot is cast into the lap, but it is God who controls how it turns out. Verse 33 of Proverbs 16, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. It would seem as though the Lord was behind this. But look at how Haman goes to the king in verse 8. Look at the subtlety and the way he does this. He says, There is a certain people. He doesn't identify them by name. There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. Do you see how there's this blend of truth and lies? Yes, there were Jews scattered throughout the provinces. And yes, the Jews had some laws that were different from everyone else's. But we have seen that there were men like a Daniel who could be a servant of King Cyrus. He could serve faithfully in his kingdom. You know, there was no reason to destroy them. You know, the loyal Jews would have done as Jeremiah had exhorted the captives, you know, much earlier than this, when he said, pray for the peace of the city where you are. You know, they would have sought God's blessing upon it. But he not only tries to say, well, these people, they don't follow the king's laws. He says, I'll make sure that 10,000 talents of silver come into the treasury. And that is just an incredible sum of money. Now, a talent is around 70 to 80 pounds. When you start talking 10,000 times 70, we're not measuring silver in ounces. You know, we're measuring it in tons. So, you know, the king gives his signet ring to Haman. In other words, you just go do what you need to do. And verse 11, when he says, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you. Some think when he says the money, he means, oh, don't worry about that part. But Esther will very clearly say in chapter 7 and verse 4, my people are sold. And when Mordecai, in this lesson as we'll see today, gets word to Esther, he mentions the money. Well, then what happens is the decree is drawn up with the king's permission. It's drawn up. It is translated into the various languages. It is sent throughout the empire under the king's seal. And what it allowed was chapter 3 and verse 13, that people were to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the month, of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. And, you know, what a awful decree this was. I might back up for just a second to point out something that it's really easy to overlook. But verse 12 says the king's scribes, they're called, in order to write this decree, they are called on the 13th day of the first month. Think for a second, what happens on the 14th day of the first month? It is the Passover. The day when the Israelites celebrate their freedom from Egyptian bondage. On the eve of that, a decree is being written for their destruction. Well, the word, you know, is being sent out, and there in the city of Susa, or Shushan, it says the people are perplexed. They don't understand why there is this decree. And look at verse 15. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. Haman's got his plot to kill. The king has signed off on it, even though he doesn't really know the reason for it. I don't know if Haman ever told him it's the Jews. But, okay, a whole bunch of folks are going to be killed. Their goods are going to be plundered and brought into the treasury of the king. but let's sit down and have a drink. Such a casual approach to life. Well, chapter 4, Mordecai, of course, he learns of it. And he tears his clothes. He puts on sackcloth and ashes. And he is in the midst of the city, verse 4, crying with a loud and bitter cry. Now, he doesn't just go weeping quietly. He is crying aloud. He went as far as the king's gate, but he didn't go in. There was a law, you couldn't go into the king's gate in sackcloth. You know, when you go into near the king, you better be a happy person. And so he doesn't go in there, but in every province, as word begins to reach out, there is weeping and fasting and wailing, and many are laying in sackcloth and ashes. Well, at some point in all of this, the maids of Esther, the eunuchs, came and told her about Mordecai. And I don't know if they knew all the details of the relationship, but some of those close to her knew there was this connection. And so what does she do? She just sends him some clothes and says, you know, you need to get out of the sackcloth. You need to be in good clothes. She sent a man named Hathach, verse 6, to go to him. Well, Mordecai informed him of all that was going on, about the money, verse 7, gave him a copy of the decree and said, you go and you show this to Esther and you explain what is happening and tell her she's got to go in and make supplication to the king. She's got to plead for her people. If she's the one that can save us. And so Hathach goes and tells Esther all that Mordecai said. And then she's got a message for Hathach. You got to go back to Mordecai and you've got to tell him that everybody around here knows that it doesn't matter who it is, man or woman. You go into the king's court without being summoned, you are going to be put to death unless he reaches out the golden scepter to you. And then she says, I haven't been called into the king for 30 days. Now, just as an aside, I talked a little bit in the previous lesson about what a travesty on marriage the whole polygamy harem thing was. Here is the woman that the king has expressed his love for her, and he will again. And yet a month has gone by without her being called into the king. Seeing this man that the two should have been one flesh. And yet she hasn't been there in a month. So basically her answer is, you go back and tell Mordecai, I wish I could help, but I can't do anything about this. And then the end of this fourth chapter is some of the most inspirational material you'll ever read. Mordecai first says, you go back and you tell her that don't think you can hide in the king's palace. You know, you are a Jew and judgment will come on you too. But he also says, if you keep silent, there will be deliverance for the Jews. Interestingly enough, he doesn't use the word God, but it's clear he believes that God will deliver them somehow. And then he asked her the question, verse 14, yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? You are a Jewish orphan, and now you're the queen of Persia. Do you think it's just an accident? Do you think it's only because you're a beautiful young lady? Do you not think there was a purpose, a plan behind all of this? Maybe this is what it was all about. And Esther, from here on, does not hesitate. She said, gather the Jews that are in Shushan, and you fast for me. And we know that typically fasting and prayer were associated together. Said, you do this for 3 days, and I and my maids will do the same thing. And then I will go to the king. It is against the law. But if I perish, I perish. She first said, I can't go in because I might die. Now she says, I will go in and try to do what I can, whether I live or I die. What a transformation. What faith. Well, the fifth chapter, just to set us up for the grand finale, the next day, and you can, and just try to picture this, Esther, not the next day, the third day, after the fasting, Esther has put on her royal robes. She is dressed in her finest, and she goes toward the king. She goes into, you know, the inner part. Let's read this and just imagine you are her. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. She may have said, if I perish, I perish. But we can only imagine the feeling she had as she stood there waiting to see what he would do. Well, she found favor with him, and he said, oh, queen, and he had to know if she would risk her life to come in there. It must be important. What do you want? I'll give to you up to half the kingdom, which, of course, is exaggeration, but it's saying, I'll do anything you want, honey. And she said, here's what I would like for you to do. I would like for you and Haman to come to a banquet that I've prepared. And so, you know, he sends word, get Haman quickly and come. And at the banquet of wine, the king says, now what is it you want? You know, I'll give you half the kingdom. And she said, here's my petition and favor. I want you to come to a banquet tomorrow that I'm doing. And then I will make my request. And of course he agrees, but you ever stop to think about Ahasuerus at this point? Thinking, she came into the court knowing it was against the law that she could lose her life. She asked me to this banquet, and now she says, you're going to have to wait another day to find out. He had to have been really, really puzzled as to what was going on. But let's go back to Haman for a moment. Haman goes out that day and, oh, you can imagine how joyful and what a glad heart he had, you know, having been honored by this great banquet. And he's telling people, you know, about his great riches, the multitude of his children, all his promotion. In verse 12, and you know, I was the only one invited in with the king. But then he says, but I can't enjoy any of this as long as that Mordecai the Jew, and notice how they keep throwing in the Jew, is sitting at the king's gate, because on the way home, he had seen Mordecai. And this is just he can't enjoy all that he has because of that one thing that he doesn't have. And his wife and his friend said, you know, you're in such a position of honor. You put up this gallows that's, you know, nearly 75 feet high, and hang, ask the king if we can't just hang Mordecai on that. Well, he thinks that's a great idea. And just say this about hanging. The inscriptions, the drawings would suggest they didn't hang a man by the neck till he was dead, as they used to say in the Old West. They killed a man, and then they impaled him. So this gallows would be something 75 or so feet tall, and then there would be a pointed stick on which the body of Mordecai was intended to be impaled and displayed for humiliation for everybody to see. Well, Haman, he's happy now. They have a plan to get rid of Mordecai. You know, even before all the Jews are going to be killed, he's going to go ahead and have Haman put to death. Now, what can we take from this that make some application in our own lives? One of the things that I think about with Haman is you look at all this man had going for him, this great promotion, great position in the kingdom, and he allowed what he considered the insult of one man to rob him of his happiness. We need to learn not to take insults personally. And we also need to learn the dangers of prejudice. It is very clear, the way that Mordecai the Jew, that he had something against the Jews. Don't let those prejudices linger in your heart. Be an Esther. And be willing to perish if need be. You know, you do what's right no matter the cost. Typically, it's not going to be perishing, but it could cost us a friendship. It could cost us a job. You know, whatever it might be, have faith. And that statement of Mordecai, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this, let us always be open to see the possibilities of how God can use us. That maybe we are where we are today, whether it be on a job, in a school, in this church, you know, in this neighborhood, for a reason. I understand Ecclesiastes talks about time and chance happens to everyone. And yet, let's be aware. Let's be awake to opportunities to serve. Have faith in God's providence. Know that He is still working in the lives of people. And lastly, another lesson from Haman. Obviously, this is a pride-filled man. Don't let pride control your life, because it will ruin your life. Humble yourself in the sight of God and of others.